Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller list, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
You can be putting up a picture that is 100% true. You didn't stage it, it's real, and it does not reflect the facts at all.
Stunning doesn't even begin to say it, our critic writes in a starred review of YA superstar Gail Forman's latest, I Have Lost My Way. In this astonishing, astute, and generous novel, a trinity of teens meets beneath a bridge in Central Park. And it's a little more cataclysmic than I'm making it sound, but we'll get to that in just a minute. Freya, Haroon, and Nathaniel are each coping with multiple layers of significant loss. But the bonds they forge that fateful day may change the course of their lives forever. Forman is the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, If I Stay, 7 additional novels for adults and teen readers, and a novella. She lives with her family in New York, but joins us today from Michigan on her book tour. Welcome, Gail, to Fully Booked. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's so good to be here, Megan.
I have lost my way. I have lost all my inhibitions when it comes to extolling the virtues of this beautiful book. How about that Kirkus review, Gail? Here, I have another line for you. The intersections of love, family, and identity, and how loss impacts them all, lay the groundwork for the breathtaking empathy and friendship that takes root among these three seemingly dissimilar teens within hours of meeting each other. End quote. That's a pretty good review from us.
It's perhaps the best review I've ever received, and not just because it says such wonderful things, but because it got the book as I wanted it to be understood. And it's also a gorgeously written review, which I think is very hard to do in such a small amount of space. So whoever did it out there at Kirkus, well done and thank you.
It's always exciting to find out that someone who has achieved your level of acclaim still reads the reviews and cares about the criticism.
I would be shocked if there's a writer out there that doesn't read the reviews and care about the criticism.
Really? You know, some people tell me they don't. Are they lying to me?
I think no. I mean, I think people don't read the reviews, but not because they're like so beyond it that they don't matter. I mean, maybe there's like 5 or 6 people out there. But I think it's more that over a long career, you understand that getting those voices in, whether they are flattering or critical, it's hard to get them back out again. So I could totally see why people don't read reviews. I don't read Goodreads reviews at all. And I, for the most part, like don't read things that I'm tagged in if I see that. But the trade reviews, I absolutely read, because sometimes there's nothing quite so awful as a bad review that feels unfair. But sometimes you get a negative review that you actually are like, oh, right, that's kind of true. And that's helpful. It's helpful the same way that getting any kind of critique is. You know, with a review, you'd rather you got it before the book came out so you could have fixed the problem, but you then sort of store that away for next time.
Totally. I mean, I Have Lost My Way is a book that deals with fame, celebrity buzz, criticism, social media, fandom, in a really thought-provoking way. So I hope we get to talk about that in this conversation. But first, would you please introduce our listeners to Freya, Haroon, and Nathaniel?
Yes. Freya is a 19-year-old singer who was an internet sensation, and then she has been sort of taken in by this super powerful music producer who's going to kind of catapult her to this sort of transcendent fame. And as she is recording this album that is supposed to achieve all that, she loses her voice. Haroon is a young second-generation Pakistani-American who has just been dumped by his boyfriend, James, the love of his life. His parents know nothing of James, nothing of who Haroon really is. That's part of the reason that he was dumped. And Haroon is about to embark upon a life that will kind of commit himself to a lie. Nathaniel is from Washington State, and he's just arrived in New York City the morning that the book begins. And he is kind of a mysterious character. He has a backpack, and he's supposed to be meeting his father. But there's something kind of a little bit off with what's going on with Nathaniel. And as you read on, you see what's going on with all three of these characters and how different they are, but they're connected by, as you already mentioned, the fact that they're grappling with deep loss.
Yeah, so all three of these characters have a relationship to the phrase, "I have lost my way," which becomes a kind of refrain. And indeed, they are the very first words of the first chapter. "I have lost my way." We see Freya typing these words into her phone. What do they mean to her in that moment?
They mean to her what they meant to me when I was struggling to write my first young adult novel in 5 years. And I'd published one in 2015, but I hadn't actually written one since 2011. And I had sort of crashed and burned on sort of 7 different projects and started to think that this thing that I had always done, that I had sort of almost taken for granted that I could do, I could no longer do. And so I just kept thinking to myself, I used to know how to do this, and I don't. It's like it's been excised for me. I've lost my way. And then after a few months of that, Freya was saying that in my ear, and it was the same for her. She has been singing since she can remember, and one day she just can't sing. And so that's how it started for Freya, and from Freya came Haroon, and from Haroon came Nathaniel.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, you know, why you selected this order of introduction for the characters, because, I mean, the subsequent title chapters suggest that order is important here. So Freya came first.
I think I introduced them in the order that they came to me. And so Freya came to me, and then it was Haroon, and then Nathaniel kind of came in last. And so the first couple chapters go in that order, but then the order started to move around. I mean, when I initially started it, I think almost as a writing prompt, I had "I have lost my way" as the first line of each of their chapters, and then I was going to carry that into subsequent chapters and realized that was actually going to hinder me. So I let that go, but it did remain a sort of pivotal point in each of their chapters early on, where they each are saying in some form or another. Freya is typing it into Twitter, Haroon is saying it in a prayer, and Nathaniel is literally saying it because he's lost.
I heard him speaking those words to, you know, a harried New Yorker, you know, rushing past, like, yeah, "I have lost my way," and, you know, just blown right by, you know, the poor guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So for him, it's more geographical in the moment. He is legit lost when he's speaking.
Well, he's lost in all the other ways too, but he's
of course
also the outsider. He thought he was taking, you know, one of those airport buses to Port Authority, and he wound up somewhere else and he doesn't know where he is. So he is legit lost.
So, I mean, you mentioned the connection to Freya. Is she the character with whom you most identify of these three?
No. Interestingly, the one I identify with the most, and the one who, as soon as the character came to me, I knew completely, is Haroon. So I'm a 47-year-old straight Jewish white lady, and he's a 19-year-old gay Muslim young man. And yet he was the one who I connected with immediately. And where with Freya and Nathaniel, I had to do a lot of like drafting and exploration to understand just why they were lost and how they'd become lost. With Haroon, I got it immediately.
There are a million directions for us to go in. What I want to talk about probably right now are lies, because in grappling with this loss, in grief and in fear, each of them is compelled to tell untruths to different people. For Freya, she, or at least her people, are telling her fans that she can still sing when she's lost her voice. For Haroon, he's not saying anything, but, you know, in the absence of that, he's saying that he's straight when he's not. And then for Nathaniel, I mean, that's a complicated story as well. He's estranged from his mother, and she doesn't even know some really significant events from the last few years of his life.
Yes, all of these characters are keeping incredible secrets. And the interesting thing, I hope, about the storytelling form, it takes place in two different forms, which is there's a present tense, which are these pretty long chapters where you are jumping from character to character, and then you get the past tense, which is first person, and you understand how they've come to be here. So the reader understands very specific things about what is going on with each of these characters, which even by the end of the book, they don't understand about each other. They kind of transcend the details, because I think that's so interesting about the details. Like social media, which we may get to, speaks a lot to that, where you can be putting up a picture that is 100% true. You didn't stage it. It's real. And it does not reflect the facts at all. So these characters have all put forward things that do not reflect the facts at all. And by the end of it, they have kind of inhabited one another's hearts to some degree that they understand without knowing all the falsehoods they've been told. They have gotten to the heart of the truth in some way. And that sort of is really what brings them out of their loss.
Absolutely. It's connecting with a person face to face or boot to head. Because as I mentioned in the introduction, they meet under a bridge in Central Park because Nathaniel, Freya falls onto him.
Yes. Freya is staring at a picture of her sister on her phone, and there's those cyclists whizzing by, and she steps and she falls off the bridge right on top of Nathaniel.
And Haroon, of course, is the witness to this scene and goes over, and they're off from there to urgent care. I hope that's not a spoiler.
I don't think that's a spoiler. That happens like in the first chapter.
Cool. Sidebar, I have lost my way to me, in addition to being an immense, utterly captivating exploration of loss and empathy, is also a love letter to New York. There are a lot of delightful, unexpected things that happen in the book that we won't mention. We'll let readers find these jewels themselves. I really love the way you captured how, you know, these characters are moving through the city. The way that Haroon and James, when we get some of the backstory, explore the secret spaces and steal moments, you know, when they go into a place and actually buy something, they call it paying rent. Gotta have a Greek diner.
So. I do. I think this is like my second book. I'm like, there's a Greek diner. You know, what you said about New York, the sort of unexpected things that happen. I've lived in the city for more than 25 years, and those things still happen. I remember once, it was years ago, I was walking to meet my friend Marjorie, and there was a guy with, the details get lost. We think it might have been a ferret, but it was like a dead ferret in a box.
Oh, no.
And we got into a long conversation about the dead ferret in the box and how it came to be. And I think that was like the Giuliani times of ferrets were a hot point issue. And I told my friend about it afterwards. And, you know, we both realized that we were the kind of person that would stop and have this long conversation with somebody about a dead ferret in a box. And New York City is full of people who will stop and have long conversations with you about a dead ferret in a box. That's the title of my next book, by the way, Dead Ferret in a Box. I'm announcing it here on your podcast.
I am truly honored, Gail. Thank you so much. And though we could probably end the interview there, we won't.
But I love the city, is my point. And I love all the unexpected things that happen all the time here. And that people, I think, from the outside don't think that that's what New York is. I think they think it's just like how Nathaniel initially encounters it. It's so unfriendly and nobody has time for anybody. But it's not like that.
No, it's not like that. I think I've had many dead ferret in a box conversations actually on the platform at Journal Square waiting for the PATH train. And of course, platform is in New Jersey, but I think that's one of the, not technically New York, but I think New York can kind of claim the Journal Square PATH station.
Absolutely. Like, and the PATH stations have such a unique smell, and it's different from anywhere else in the city. Whenever somebody says PATH stations, I just get the olfactory memory of how they smell.
I get cold
Yeah.
Speaking of claiming, this is rather nebulously, you know, formed in my mind, but I want to kind of talk about what it means to claim another person as our own and what it means to be a caregiver. Freya is called out in the book as never being in charge of anyone. You know, like someone is always in charge of her. First it's her father, then it's her older sister, and then it's her manager, this star maker who is going to make her the next big one-name singing sensation. She really doesn't claim, you know, she's not in charge of anybody else. They're in charge of her. Until she meets these two new friends, really.
Yeah.
Why is that significant for her? What does that do for her?
I think there's this idea that when you are going through a rough time and you are sort of in need, the last thing that you need is to be there for somebody else. And in some cases, that is absolutely true. Like sometimes you just like need to be the person that is taken care of. But sometimes the opposite is true. Sometimes it can be so healing just to be generous for another human being. It takes you out of yourself. It takes you out of your own problems. It connects you with someone. And that is what Freya needs. And that is sort of the big revelation for her, is that taking on these other people's loss while she's dealing with so much of her own, it would seem to be a burden, but it's the opposite. It relieves her burden. And I think that sometimes gets lost. We're all like, oh, I don't have time to deal with that. And you forget that it can be wonderful to help somebody else. And you also forget that it can be an act of generosity to ask for or accept somebody else's help, which I think that is a tough lesson for some of us.
It's interesting because, speaking of opposites, Nathaniel, from a young age, Nathaniel grows up, his primary caregiver becomes his father, who kind of, like, you might think if you heard about this being your friend's dad, like, he's really cool. Like, he reads with him and he plays with him and he considers the two of them a fellowship of two, like from the Lord of the Rings,
which he reads to him at like 8, 7.
Yeah. You know, it sounds like a lot of fun, but in practice, he's not the most responsible dad.
No. In fact, if we're talking about caretakers, Nathaniel often winds up more the caretaker for his father than vice versa. And so here is somebody who has spent his life not being taken care of. And when that happens over and over again, when the people in your life who should be taking care of you, at least at some point, fail, you start to think that maybe you're unworthy, or Nathaniel certainly does, that there's something wrong with him that would repel people who should be there, who should love him. And so he does in part what people in that situation do, which is like, well, I'm just going to repel you first. I'm going to push you out before you have a chance to push me, because he's been let down by so many of the people in his life, whether it's his parents or his coach or his friends, who should have sort of seen what was going on with this young man.
You may just, like, on a tangent, talk about kind of problematic parents in YA fiction. Like, is that a thing?
Problematic parents? Well, here's, in YA fiction and all of children's literature, in order to actually tell a story about kids, you need the parents to either be like the horrible antagonists, or preferably they should just be completely out of the picture, dead. And that is why, like, all of those gruesome middle grade novels have parents, adults, killed straight away. I've been reading the Lemony Snicket books with my youngest daughter, and it's like, effectively, parents dead straight away, because otherwise those Baudelaire orphans don't have any issues whatsoever. So I think because I didn't start writing young adult novels until I myself was a parent, and I'm egocentric, I wasn't willing to push the parents out of the way. So in If I Stay, I got to have really wonderful parents because I did kill them. But in the rest of my novels, I have parents that are thorny and troublesome, because I think whether you have a great relationship with your parents or not, usually when you're a teenager, they are the largest relationship in your life. Mm-hmm. In novels, we like to think it's the best friend, or it's the boyfriend or the girlfriend, but really, I think parents are so singular and so important. So I think all of my books have had very, very strong parent characters, not always positive. Sometimes they're quite antagonistic, sure. But that seems to be, true to who people these age are. Mm. And all three of these characters have some interesting parental dynamics.
I'll say. Speaking of relationships, what's your relationship to the three people to whom you've dedicated this book?
I dedicated the book to Anna Jarzeb, Michael Brett, and Ken Wright. And so Ken is my publisher and friend at Penguin. And he's somebody who sort of had the front row seat to my crisis of confidence breakdown. He's been expecting a book from me for years and, you know, contracted me to write one book. And then I'm like, wait, it's in this one. And then he was like, okay, it'll be that one. And then there was radio silence. So he knew what was going on, and he was so human and humane about it and lovely. Michael is my agent, who's also a very good friend of mine and the person to whom I kind of went finally saying, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't think I can do this anymore. I don't know if I can do it anymore. And told him the truth about like the seven novels that I crashed and burned on, because I didn't tell them what I was working on. I just got very secretive. And then Anna is a friend of mine. We used to work together at Penguin, and she had a period in between jobs. And so she was somebody who was a friend, but not a super close friend. She's somebody who knew my work, but who was not personally invested in it. And so she was kind of the first person who rescued me, because I needed to go to somebody a little bit outside of the circle. And so I called her up and I said, hey, I want to hire you to read everything and tell me if you think any of this is viable and what I should do. And she immediately sort of focused on this one, because the characters had burrowed into her heart, and it was just the most disastrous draft at that point. And then she helped me. Like, I called her on the phone all the time. I never had such a hard time sort of figuring something out until I could finally get past that point of the point of return, I should say, because all the other books, I think I suffered this crisis of confidence, and maybe if I'd stuck with it, they would have gotten there, but I convinced myself that I couldn't, and therefore I couldn't. And with this one, she kind of dragged me past that line to where I could start to see where it could actually be a book.
So a true fellowship.
Yes. Yes. This is my three.
Did you do any research about music and singing for this book?
Yes. I have some friends who do recording. And so I did research about music and singing. But more of the research was really about how people get big in this day and age, because when I wrote Where She Went years ago, it was a much different trajectory of how bands on the rise and the kind of momentum and the recording contract. Now with the internet, you can kind of like leapfrog over that. And so I had always known Freya was going to be like an internet celebrity, but I thought, oh, she's like Justin Bieber. But Justin Bieber, the world has changed five times over since he was discovered. And so I spent a lot of time looking at YouTube stars and kind of understanding that world, and how many of them, how there could be these people that were massively famous in this one realm that we'd never heard of. That really informed Freya, not just the kind of the mechanics of how she would have risen up the ranks, but also it helped me to understand her psychology and how much she relied on the external validation for all the things. I mean, that was sort of how she measured her career and herself.
There's this particularly excellent exchange between her and Hayden, the Stormmaker. And in it, he kind of breaks it down for her, the difference between buzz, celebrity, and fame. Could you break that down for us?
Yeah, I loved writing Hayden.
Yeah,
it's just so delightfully despicable. And so he has this whole speech that he gives her. And right now, anybody can get their 15 minutes of fame. I think he talks about, I probably dated myself, but I couldn't resist, like, you can have a Chewbacca suit and do a video and you're famous and people will remember you for that. And people will then maybe try and capitalize on that and kind of cross over, or you'll have people who are famous in a certain realm. But the kind of fame that he wants for Freya, that he achieves, is, you know, to be a one-named wonder, to be a Lorde or a Beyonce or an Adele, and how she needs to transcend out of that. And that's what he was going to do. And so he explained to her that you know, there's buzz and then there's celebrity, but those are not the same thing as fame. And he creates fame, and he wants to create fame for her.
Speaking of Lorde, don't you have a Lorde concert to get to in Detroit later tonight?
Yeah, it's breaking my heart. I am following her. We're crisscrossing the country, missing each other. And I just found out I'm in East Lansing and she's in Detroit. And I've been desperately trying to think, like, can I get the event done in time and then forget the hotel reservation, reserve a new hotel, get the car back, because I'm flying out of Detroit tomorrow morning. And I don't know if I can make the math work.
You see, that's fame, though. That's, Lorde is famous.
She is. I mean, she's amazing. And also, I mean, I did think about her quite a bit when I was writing this. Not that she's a model for Freya, although musically, when I think of, you know, what kind of music Freya would be making, it would be this. And I can't stop listening to the song Liability for so many reasons. But she was just so young when she broke out.
I think we've talked about pretty much everything I can fit in my brain. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about this novel?
I don't know, Megan, what should we tell them? My brain stopped working a while ago. Once we started talking about Lord, it was all over.
Yeah, it was all over. Do you love writing for teens?
I love writing teen characters, and I love writing for teens too. Teens are amazing. I did my launch event yesterday at a middle school, and kids came and they sang the song. So there's a song in the book called Little White Dress that we recorded. We arranged into a real song and recorded, and a 13-year-old singer named Sasha Abner sang it, and she's just fantastic, and you can kind of download that. But
cool.
We launched the event, the book at a school, and 1,000 middle schoolers came out, and it was an arts middle school, and so students were acting it out. There were students singing the song. They had their strings department playing the violin and cello, and we had a pianist. So they had the music live. We had the singers, the chorus with soloists. It was incredible. So I absolutely love writing for teens, and I have realized they're so much better at so much of the kind of performative aspect of storytelling that I'm enlisting them. So they're drawing art for my Instagram page, and they're recording songs for me. But I love, to get back to your question, I make the distinction that I write about young people, but I don't write young stories. So that the stories that are on my mind that I'm dealing with, those are what filter into the books that I am writing. But it's always these young people who come to kind of drive the bus. And I never really thought about why until my last book, which was an adult novel. And then I did think about why, which is that I think adults are told that as you mature, your feelings will mellow and you will not feel things as strongly. And if you do, there is something wrong with you. And I think that is such a myth. I think we probably learn not to have like hissy fits every time something doesn't go our way. That is what maturity is. But that feelings remain that intense. But adults are told that that's not acceptable, so they get bottled. And I think a lot of adult literature has to do with the kind of sublimation or things that happen when you are refusing to own up to what's going on. In young adult novels, I think teenagers are really given license to feel their feels. So when you are writing them, you can kind of dispense with some of the bullshit and get to the heart of the matter. And there's an urgency to it and a purity. And it's very exhilarating to write that way as a writer. And I enjoy reading that way as well. So I think that is why.
Wow, Gail. Like, first of all, brava. That was an amazing answer. And I feel like you just like, I just like ascended to a higher level of book critic enlightenment hearing that. Like, that sounded like an essential truth to me. So thank you very much for that.
Well, thank you. I've been thinking about it because I've just been sort of blithely saying like, well, yeah, I don't write, you know, I'm writing about stuff that's on my mind now. I'm not going back and reliving my high school days. But then I thought like, why? After I'd written a novel about people my own age, then I had to start asking myself, well, what is the difference? Because the writing process was not different at all. It's the same excavation of character through draft and draft and draft. But Mary Beth, the character in Leave Me, like so much of what's going on with her is that she's just in such deep denial about how she's feeling. And the characters in I've Lost My Way might be in denial about why it is they're feeling the way they're feeling, but they're not in denial of how they're feeling.
Well, I cannot wait for our listeners to meet Freya, Haroon, and Nathaniel. The novel is I Have Lost My Way. Gail Forman, thank you once more for joining us on Fully Booked.
Thank you for having me.
I love that last question you asked and what she said about, you know, writing for teens, but putting adult issues in the books.
Yeah, and that just really helped me put words onto my own understanding of what she does and what she does so well. She's a great YA author, one of the best.
Yeah, no, and she's also interesting because she's sort of migrated from, you know, back and forth between writing for teens and for adults. So when she says that she loves writing for teens but includes adult issues, she knows exactly what she's talking about there.
Absolutely.
And I also love what she said about letting teens feel the feels.
Yeah.
So she has the teen lingo down.
Yeah, we could all do with a little more of feeling our feels.
That is so true.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.
Don't miss the debut episode of The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner and his very first guest, Adam Sandler.
I was shooting Little Nicky and my father came to the set. You heard about this new Krispy Kreme donut? And then I'm eating like two or three and talking to him and he's like, how many are you going to have? I said, that's it. And he's like, you do that every day?
Download new episodes of The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner every Thursday on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to rate and review on Apple Podcasts.
This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
I have big feels for the movie 2001. And there's a great new book out about the making of it that is just fascinating. It was such a complex movie to get made. And of course, it changed film history. So I'm going to talk to Michael Benson in a second.
Awesome. I can't wait for this one.
Yeah. Michael Benson is an artist, writer, and filmmaker, a fellow of the New York Institute of the Humanities, and a past visiting scholar at the MIT Media Lab. His new book, Space Odyssey, Stanley Kubrick, Arthur C. Clarke, and the Making of a Masterpiece, is a fascinating account of how 2001, A Space Odyssey, was made. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hey, thanks a lot for having me on.
So this is a question that I know is going to have a complex answer, but for people who don't know, can you just talk a little bit about what the collaboration between Stanley Kubrick, the filmmaker, and Arthur C. Clarke, the well-known science fiction writer and sort of visionary, was like?
Well, you know, by all accounts, they really got along well, even though a lot of tension arose in the second half of their collaboration because Kubrick didn't want Clarke to publish the novel version of their mutually conceived narrative before the film came out. So he was kind of evading or backing down from a verbal agreement that they had had early on. And Clarke really needed the money because he had all these financial drains on his resources, or drains on his financial resources, I should say. So there was some tension there, which even, one of the things I uncovered is that at one point, Clarke even threatened Kubrick with a lawsuit, which is not the way I would have anybody remember their relationship, because it was an exceptionally rare kind of interaction between them. In general, they saw eye to eye. And, we're talking about two really brilliant people. I only got to know one of them. That was Clarke. Clarke was absolutely brilliant and humorous and, you know, multifaceted in the sense that he really knew a lot about a lot of different fields. And Kubrick was the kind of guy who just absorbed information, all day, and retained it somehow. Very, very, very intelligent. Very brilliant. So the two of them, and neither of them, both of them, let's say, were not without ego. You can't become a major film director without having, an ego. But and Clarke, made fun of himself for his ego. He actually sent an email to his friends every December, called it an egogram. So he kind of made fun of himself, but somehow both of them had a lot of humility as well. And I think that really helped them in their interactions with each other. They were both highly curious you know, and so they had that kind of humility that comes with knowing that even if they have some accomplishments under their belt, there's a lot left to do and a lot left to learn.
Right, right. And so you got to spend time with Arthur Clarke, but Kubrick had died, but you did spend time with his widow, is that right?
Yeah, Christiane, indeed.
Yeah, so Kubrick himself was sort of a pretty private person. Was she forthcoming about him and the making of this movie?
She was completely forthcoming, perhaps even to the point where Stanley would have been saying, hey, maybe you could, you don't have to tell so much. But I think she judged me as somebody, you know, thankfully, she judged me as somebody worthy of her confidence. And she told me a lot of really interesting and telling things. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I don't quite agree about him being, I mean, he was private in the sense that he wasn't really comfortable going in front of the media, mm-hmm. Kubrick, but he wasn't really private in that, I mean, he has a kind of, he had a reputation of being a bit of a recluse, which I think is totally unfounded. Mm-hmm. He was constantly interacting with people. It's just that he always did it on his own terms. You know, he was always initiating conversations, inviting people to come visit with him. He was on the phone at all hours of the day and the night, you know, talking to people all over the world about, you know, whatever problem was obsessing him at the moment. So he was really very far from being a recluse or a shy person, certainly not. Yeah. It's just he didn't like to be, you know, in front of cameras. He liked to be behind cameras.
Yeah, yeah. So there's an interesting story about the way that this movie was sort of received when it came out. I mean, initially, both critics and audiences didn't really take to it. But talk a little bit about how that changed.
Well, the initial audiences were invitation only and mostly entitled representatives of the media elite and the entertainment elite, predominantly older people, people who were used to a certain type of film, certain type of narrative structure, et cetera, et cetera. So the first paying on it, to continue about them. It's true that the initial previews were a complete disaster. Lots of people walking out. Dead silence at the end of the screening and the first, you know, premiere screening in Washington, D.C. on April 2nd. More than 200 walkouts in the New York premiere the following day.
Yeah. And just to ask about that, the pacing of this movie is sort of glacial pace. I mean, that was something that hadn't really been seen in exactly this way. I mean, was that one of the things that turned people off, or was it its length, or...
Well, one thing that people don't necessarily know is that the first cut, the cut that the media saw, I should say the elite reviewers saw in the beginning, and those initial audiences saw, was 20 minutes longer than the one that we know today.
Right.
So Kubrick cut it down following these disastrous preview screenings and premiere screenings. And by all accounts, the elimination of certain redundant scenes really did have a significant impact on the viewer experience, if I could put it that way. You know, there was one scene that had Keir DeLay, who played the mission commander or astronaut on the Discovery spacecraft going to Jupiter. There was a scene where he was running in circles in the centrifuge set, you know, this very impressive rotating hamster wheel, high-tech hamster wheel of a set. And that would have been, you know, well and good, but it was after a very similar sequence with his, you know, his co-actor, you know, who played assistant commander Gary Lockwood, you know, who also was running in circles and, you know, shadow boxing, et cetera, et cetera. So the information I have is that when that second scene came on with Keir DeLay doing the same thing, there was almost like an audience revolt in the New York screening with people, you know, whistling and catcalling and so on. So these are miscalculations that come from not having had the chance to do test screenings, you know, to spend time with your first cut and evaluate it and so forth, which is, you know, kind of regular practice now. So as Variety pointed out in mid-April 68, it's really too bad that the initial critical response came from the first cut and not the second one. So that was one reason for the rocky initial reception. And another was that it was, as you said, the pace was different from what you might expect. It was slow, methodical, I would argue extraordinarily, you know, beautiful, lyrical, you know. And the pace was correct for the content, et cetera, et cetera. But people weren't used to that, especially people above a certain age weren't used to that. And plus the film, you know, is very much an audiovisual experience before it is anything based on words. Words are important. I mean, you know, the HAL 9000 computer pleading for its life as it's being deprogrammed is one of the most extraordinary scenes ever filmed. And of course, the words were important. Words were important in the film, but, you know, there's less than 40 minutes of dialogue in the whole film, and the film is almost 2.5 hours.
And so Kubrick was able to adapt and cut 20 minutes out. How then did it actually become a popular film? I mean, you mentioned that people above a certain age, you know, couldn't really take to this film. But with younger audiences, it just sort of took off, right?
Absolutely. And immediately, there was a mythology for many years that the film was sputtering and was about to be withdrawn by MGM. And then the younger generation came riding into its rescue. But the facts, you know, the box office statistics don't lie. And the film was a huge hit from day one. And it was mostly younger audiences going to see it and some of them going to see it repeatedly. They didn't need any explanation for the narratives. I mean, you know, the narrative or the ambiguity of it. You know, the film is willfully and intentionally ambiguous at every stage when Kubrick could have spelled out meanings. He left it to the viewer to decide what the meanings were. That's one reason we're talking about the film today, because it rewards that. It rewards the imagination of the viewer in a way that a novel can. Sometimes film is accused of being too obvious compared to the written word, because when you read a book, your imagination has to, in effect, paint pictures and so forth. Somehow Kubrick found a way to produce a film that was very open to multiple interpretations, but not in a way that was infuriatingly confusing. I mean, some people were, of course, infuriated. Some people left early, as we just discussed. But in particular, the younger generation didn't need for things to be explained. They understood in a kind of visceral way what was going on.
Can we talk about carbon dioxide poisoning for the actors? Because it seems to have been like a constant threat on the set of this film.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's really one of the episodes that has not been out there before, really hasn't, is Bill Weston, the stuntman's heroic stunts hanging from a wire 30 feet above a hard concrete studio floor with no safety net in a hermetically sealed spacesuit that Kubrick wouldn't let him punch air holes into. I mean, it's an absolutely extraordinary thing. Bill Weston, you know, asked Kubrick if he could put some holes in the back of the helmet so that he could get some air in there, you know, and Kubrick was worried that light would leak in. And he refused. And Weston did have an oxygen bottle in his backpack. I mean, you would think that if the thing looks like a spacesuit, maybe they could make it work more like a spacesuit than it actually did. But there was no way to remove the carbon dioxide building up as he was involved and performed extremely athletically challenging feats. Hanging from a wire above that floor. And so each time he did it, he only had 10 minutes before he started blacking out. And I tell the story in the book about how he had worked out a signaling system where if he made a kind of crucifix shape with his arms, you know, twice, it meant mayday, mayday, take me in. I need to take this helmet off and breathe, you know. And the first time he tried that, he heard Kubrick down below saying, no, no, I haven't gotten the shot yet. Leave him up there. You know, and then when he actually did pass out and when he woke up, he went off to find Kubrick and teach him a lesson, as he said. This was a former mercenary in South Africa. This is a guy who you don't want to mess with if he's really angry. And Kubrick fled the scene, fled the studio for several days. And then finally, after a lot of you know, soothing of Weston's, you know, nerves, including a pay raise. Back came Kubrick and everybody was friends again. But and that was, as you pointed out, there were other examples of carbon dioxide buildup, including in the centrifuge. Trying to remember which others. There were problems there. I mean, they were working within very tightly constrained sets and sometimes with a lot of physical activity, you know, as I said, jogging and so forth.
Yeah, the actors playing the apes couldn't really breathe very well either. But
that's right.
You know, this,
that's right. That's the other big example of that. Indeed.
But, you know, this the fact that Weston sort of, you know, went after Kubrick, I mean, it is really telling because they're, you know, one of the interesting, I guess, lessons from this book is that, you know, an artist who's a perfectionist, that artists should be perfectionists, but that there are serious consequences for being a perfectionist to the degree that Kubrick was. I mean, there was also an episode where, I guess, during the daily rushes, an actor brought a gun in, an empty gun, an unloaded gun, and shot any actor who pointed out a mistake because...
No, it wasn't. Well, okay, that was a practical joke set up between Doug Trumbull, the visual effects supervisor, and one of his colleagues, and it was really in the spirit of fun, not
killing someone.
No, and it was a starter pistol for a track, so it was loaded, but it had a loud blank in it, and it's true they really shocked the room, and it was a way of, you know, kind of getting back at Kubrick for his perfectionism. So you really got that right in the sense that Kubrick was constantly saying, okay, I see a little tiny error in at the very end of that shot that took you weeks and weeks to accomplish. We got to do it again. You know,
right.
And this happened over and over. And so finally, that's when they set up this little scene where one person stood up and said, who fucked up the shot this time? and then Trumbull stood up and said, you're embarrassing me. And then the first guy pulled out the starter gun and shot him, you know, seemingly, and he fell to the ground and everybody was completely shocked. And then it became clear it was a practical joke at the end of it.
Right.
But, you know, if you look at Kubrick's career, you had various people having nervous breakdowns from working with him because he was such a perfectionist. And you're right. There are consequences for that level of attention to detail and perfectionism.
Well, this is a great read. The book is Space Odyssey. Thanks for your time, Michael, and I really loved reading it.
Oh, great. Well, thanks a lot, and I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about it.
You know, I was really interested to discover that it was really younger audiences that made the movie so popular. I was negative 12 when this film came out.
Well, Michael Benson was 6 years old. His mother actually took him to see it as a 6-year-old, which that's a very different household than the household I grew up in. But, you know, I mean, you've seen the movie. So like these trippy sort of psychedelic scenes at the end of the movie that sort of jolt you through time. I mean, what he was saying about older audiences not really getting into the film, I think that latter part of the film might be one of the reasons why.
Yeah, and it really made me remember that things were a lot less vague in general in media before.
Yeah, I mean, no test screenings for this film, and the media was much more... he kept referring to the media elite, you know? They were much more sort of concentrated at that time, and today there's so many more ways to publish criticism. So, speaking of critics, should we call up our editors to see which bestsellers they are liking?
Please.
Alrighty, let's do it. All right, we've got our editors on the phone. Laura Simeon is our young adult editor. Laurie Muchnick is our fiction editor. Eric Liebetrau is our nonfiction editor. And Vicky Smith, our children's editor, is at the Bologna Children's Book Fair. So we're going to miss her this week. So, Laura, what are we liking in young adult books this week?
So there's a new book out from Jesse Andrews. It's called Munmun. That's spelled M-U-N-M-U-N. And I predict it's going to do very well. His book, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, was one of our best of 2012. And Mun Mun, it's a clever satire of our society. He's created this world where status is based on wealth. So Mun Mun is money. And your physical size is in direct proportion to how much Mun Mun you have. So it's a way of, it's basically a way of illustrating the impact of inequality very directly. So for example, there's a lot of invented language in it. If you're a little poor, you're the size of a rat. If you're a big rich, you can be hundreds of feet tall.
Oh my God, he's borrowing from the master of satire, Jonathan Swift.
Yes, exactly. And hopefully young adult readers will make that connection and then, seek out Swift. But yeah, it's got a lot of, it sets up all these great situations. So for example, the protagonist's mother is attacked by a cat and she needs to go to the hospital, but the doctors are all big rich. She's little poor. So you have this problem of trying to be treated by someone who doesn't have the materials to treat somebody your size. You're the size of their hand. So anyway, it's a great book. It's sort of savage and hilarious.
Oh, that's awesome. And it also feels like we don't get a ton of satire in YA. So it's really nice to hear you recommend that one. Well, thank you.
I think I would probably be the size of a smart purse.
Probably.
Yeah, I think that's about right. This sounds great. It's one I look forward to reading. Turning now to fiction, Lori, what's your choice for this week's book?
I've got a really great romance novel this week. Ooh. It's called A Princess in Theory by Alyssa Cole. Cole had two novels out last year, An Extraordinary Union and A Hope Divided. An Extraordinary Union was one of our best romances of 2017. And those books are both set during the Civil War era. There's like a formerly enslaved person who becomes a spy for the Union Army, stuff like that. They are really great books. This is the first in a new series that's a contemporary sort of fantasy. It kind of might appeal to fans of Black Panther. The hero is a prince in a fictional African country who finds the woman who had been betrothed to him when they were toddlers and whose parents had taken her out of the country and left, when she was just a few years old, and they haven't seen each other in decades. Mm. And the woman, Naledi, has no idea who she is or what any of this is. She has actually spent her life in foster care, and now she's in graduate school. She's trying to be an epidemiologist, but she's also waitressing and, trying to make ends meet and really having kind of a hardscrabble life in New York. And Prince Tabiso comes in having found her and wants to kind of sweep her up and bring her back and marry him. But she thinks that he is the new waiter that has been sent in for her to train. And he takes advantage of the fact that she doesn't know who he is to, do a sort of prince and the pauper thing, see if she really loves him and see what it's like to be a regular man. And the sparks just completely fly in this book. And it's got a great sense of humor and a really unusual heroine. It's just a really fun book. And it's got a cool purple and teal cover that I really like.
I'm really feeling romance lately, Lori. I think that maybe we should split off and do a romance podcast next.
That's a good idea.
I do have one question. Something I've been thinking about is the going rate, like in romance authorship, still nom de plume. Like, do you know if Alyssa Cole is the author's given name or?
That's a really good question, because people who use nom de plume, they sound just like regular names, like Sarah McLean. I know that's not her real name, even mm-hmm. though it's not like a fancy name. It just sounds like a name. So Alyssa Cole, no, I don't know if that's her real name or not.
So Eric, we don't use that many nom de plumes in nonfiction, do we?
We do not. Yeah. And certainly not in this case.
Yeah. What have you chosen?
Well, this to me was the no-brainer. It's number one. It's first week. It's Russian Roulette, the inside story of Putin's war on America and the election of Donald Trump. It's by two of our top investigative journalists, Michael Isikoff with Yahoo News and David Korn with Mother Jones, the Washington Bureau.
Right.
And it's just an unbelievable expose of a lot of the fire behind all the smoke that we've been seeing for months now. And, of course, it's going to be denied up and down in certain areas, but it's extremely well researched. It's just unbelievable how entangled the Russian state and intelligence was in the possibilities of future elections. And it's just, it's a great read for anyone who's into politics. There's, you know, pretty much shocking revelations on every page. A reviewer said, if you're puzzled why the sitting president isn't going after the Russians for election tampering and other bad behavior, this is just the book to explain. So I feel this, it'll be on the bestseller list for weeks, I'm sure.
You know, in a broader sense, this book is really showing what a good investigative book can do, because we hear, yes, you know, these little tidbits about the Russian sort of episode come out every single day, if not, you know, more than once a day. And it's so confusing. And I'm a news hound. Like, I love to follow this mm-hmm. story, but it's so confusing. And a book like this really lays it out clearly and gives you context and background. And so it's really a book that can help readers, I think.
Yeah, I think the context and the synthesis is what's so important. This, you know, it's probably 300 pages, so it's not overly long, but it covers everything. And it does, like you said, context is so important, especially the way we get our news these days. And this is a great example, like you said, of what investigative journalism can do in book form.
Well, great. Well, thanks, guys. Those were some great picks. We hope you join us next week. We're going to be talking to Sloane Crossley about her new collection of essays, Look Alive Out There. Until then, you know what to do. Turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
The hit true crime series, Murder Made Me Famous, is now on Podcast One, showcasing some of the most notorious crimes imaginable, including Scott Peterson, Jodi Arias, Ted Bundy, and more. See how murder made them famous. New episodes starting every Tuesday on Apple Podcasts, as well as PodcastOne.com and the Podcast One app. And check out the new season of Murder Made Me Famous starting Saturday, April 14th on The Reels channel.
Shopping for skincare is frustrating. Buy it, try it, toss it, repeat. Curology is here to help. Curology pairs with your own licensed dermatology provider who assesses your skin and prescribes you a custom formula to tackle acne, dark spots, or even fine lines. No guesswork, just a formula made to work for you. Get your consultation today at Curology.com/SXM. Curology, skincare with a face. Subject to consultation, subscription required. Cancel anytime.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.